Welcome to the Social Impactors Podcast. This podcast is all about impact. We work to highlight impactful individuals making positive social change in their communities. From coaches, authors, entrepreneurs, influencers, we tap into the minds of some of the most impactful people around the world to find out how they have built a life of creating impact. Now listen in and be ready to go on a journey of enlightenment, motivation, and awe. Social impact everywhere.
Okay, so hi everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Social Impactors Podcast, a podcast where we highlight impactful people making positive social change in their communities. And today we have a guest, Firdaus, and I said your first name right. And you know, it's an absolute pleasure to be on the podcast with you. I know I said I had the chance to look through what you've done, and I mean, if there's any definition of social impact, it's what you've done throughout your life. So Firdaus, thank you for being on the show. And if you can just give a little introduction of who you are, what you do, and you know, why you're a social impactor.
Well, thanks very much for that very kind and generous introduction. It's a pleasure for me to be on your program. Who I am, my name is Firdaus Karas, as you know, as you said. And what I do is I basically make media for behavior change. So media for social change. And you can define that, and there are many different formats of doing that. So what I have specialized in and what I'm best known for are animated shorts, but I also do live action videos and documentaries and other formats as well. But I think I'm most famous for the animated shorts I've done. So I started doing this in Ottawa about 24 years ago and have been doing it ever since then. And if you want to see any of my work, anybody can go to my Vimeo channel. Just put my name in Vimeo and you will find a channel with about 3,675 videos currently in 325 different language versions. So my videos have one way or the other been used, as far as I know, in 198 countries. We can track those on Vimeo, including North Korea and Iran and all kinds of other countries. We know at least 1 billion people have seen them. And we think that more than 1 billion people have seen them, but we can't quantify, we can't say for certain more than a billion. So what these animations are called behavior change communications. They're trying to get people to change their behavior. And usually they're on issues like children's rights, human rights, a lot of disease prevention. I worked on Ebola, polio, migraine, headaches just recently. All kinds of HIV/AIDS, all kinds of disease prevention, and various kinds of social, other social issues. So I try to talk directly to the viewer to get them to change their mind, to change their behavior. And how you do that is you create what is called cognitive dissonance. And basically, what we're trying to do is get somebody to shift from what they are doing to something else and change their behavior. And how I do that across many cultures and many boundaries and many religions and many ethnicities is simply to appeal to the common denominators that we all have in our core. And I think those common denominators are values. So, for example, I can create a malaria prevention program using two funny and awfully mosquitoes, appealing to the fact that no mother in their world, doesn't matter what language they speak, doesn't matter which ethnicity they are, doesn't matter what citizenship they have, no mother wants their child to get malaria and die. And therefore, you can appeal to the commonalities, the values that we all hold basic as human beings. So that's basically what I do.
And one thing that I've realized, and you do it so well, is that video can be such a good medium to transcend language, right? And there might not have to be a language component, but if you're able to give a message, it's very easy to understand that message across the world and across languages, right?
Absolutely. In fact, the first program that I worked on was actually UNICEF's program. This is in the mid-1990s, all the cartoons for children's rights, and we had absolutely no language in it at all. Mm-hmm. We just used music and a card at the end to make the point that children have certain rights that are enshrined in the convention on the rights of children. That series actually started my thinking, and I still continue it to this day. So I actually give credit to two people at UNICEF who worked on this project, came up with the idea of this project. We played them collectively on 2,200 broadcasters around the world. Wow. And it became the most watched medium, the most watched animation around the world. And this is in the days when we had to send broadcast quality tapes to broadcasters. So it was absolutely amazing the impact that we had at that time. And that began my journey that continues today. So it started in the mid-1990s. I created in Ottawa what I called a hybrid company, because nowadays you have a term for the company. It's called a social enterprise or a B corporation in the U.S. But in the 5 years ago, there was no such term, and so I created what I used to call a hybrid company, which is combining for-profit work with non-profit objectives of making a social impact, as you say.
Wow. And so the follow-up question then, because it's, I don't even know how to ask it fully now, but maybe just encapsulating everything you've done, you know, through the past 1990s up until now, how are you making that positive impact in your communities? And I'll just expand, because your communities are both local and international, right? So what does that look like?
Well, what that looks like is every project in every country is different. So I can't kind of generalize the answer. I can only tell you that what I'm trying to do is get people to internalize the messages that I make, and then for them to make their own changes. I don't ever impose a change. I don't create the change in a person. They create the change themselves, or I create a catalyst, a tool which is a catalyst for discussion, and the other person they're discussing it with makes them see the light and make the change. Mm-hmm. Now, how does that work in reality? Well, I'll give an example. Right now, I'm working with UNICEF in Myanmar on infant and women's mortality. So we know that about 47,000 infants die in the first 100 days of life in Myanmar. We know that about 3,000 women die at childbirth in Myanmar. Wow. We're trying to reduce that by perhaps 50 or 60%, which is like 30,000 lives. And what I've done is I've created 15 animated shorts that they will play on national television, both on the terrestrial broadcasters and on the digital private broadcasters. I'm giving them 20,000 DVDs to put into every community health center, hospital, doctor's office, and so on to play locally. They have bought or are buying 40,000 tablets, and they will put my animations on the tablets, and then every midwife in the country or doctor or nurse that deals with the women during pregnancy will play the appropriate animation as the woman goes from being pregnant initially through the birth through 18 months afterwards. So in a year, for example, how do we know it works? In a year, we will know if we reduce the number of deaths of infants under 100 days of life. And we will know whether or not less women are dying at childbirth. Now, there might be many factors that contribute to this, and this might be one factor, but nevertheless, it will have made a difference if the number is significantly reduced. So on HIV/AIDS, for example, some years ago during the height of the crisis in South Africa in particular, there were about 3.2 million people were HIV positive, and at that point there were no drugs to keep people alive, the antiretroviral drugs. So people were dying. I mean, HIV was basically a death sentence at that time. And we had a campaign that began there and subsequently went out in 45 languages and was used in over 150 countries. And it was three funny animated condoms. So it went on national television in four South African languages and on the South African Broadcasting Corporation. And then we watched the sales of condoms go up. So we could actually track the number of condom sales going up, and then an NGO, an American-based NGO, had a formula to figure out how many lives, how many HIV infections had been prevented as a result of the condom sales going up. And the condom sales were dramatic. I mean, they more than doubled in 1 year. So again, there might be many other awareness programs or factors that contributed to that. I wouldn't say that I was the only one doing that, but it certainly did have an impact. So every project, every country, depending on what the initiative is, has an impact. Some of them you can't measure the impact. For example, right now I'm working in the Congo on trying to change the attitudes of men towards rape victims. That means after the rape has happened. I had done a program to prevent the rapes anyway on a global basis called No Excuses, but this was different. And this particular one, to try and change the attitudes of men, I thought we would be playing them to men, you know, to get them to change the attitude. No, I was completely wrong. It's women who have been watching it. Women by their thousands have been coming to community halls and so on, and playing them and watching them in churches. And then the women took them out of Congo into neighboring countries like Zambia and Tanzania. And then some women took it over to Nigeria, to the northeast part of Nigeria, where Boko Haram, this terrible organization, has raped a very large number of young girls. So the women are using it as a catalyst to get discussions going. They stand up, they talk about their own rapes or their daughter's rapes, and they talk amongst themselves. And that's how the video is just a catalyst for them. So the local people are taking the initiative. Now, I can't tell you whether I've changed a single person's attitude in the Congo. I have no idea, and we can't measure it. There's a conflict going on in the eastern southern part of Congo. It's a dangerous place. I have no idea, but sometimes you can measure things and sometimes you can't, and just kind of put it out, and you get a lot of anecdotal evidence, but you don't actually get statistical evidence.
Yeah.
It's absolutely fine with me. Look, if my work has influenced one person's life, you know, that's enough for me, absolutely enough for me.
And that's the one thing that I love about these kind of initiatives, where you use, you know, mediums like video, mediums like music. I don't know if you're aware of Global Citizen, but I've worked with them for a while too, and they're using music as an outlet for making impactful change, right? These are real indirect ways of making very direct change.
Absolutely.
I love that that you're able to do this, and as much as it might not be measurable, again, like you're saying, you know, one life could be a ripple effect for so many more.
Yeah, absolutely. And you never know where that one life is. I mean, you know, we might have a man and a woman sitting and watching television. The man is beating up their children. A spot comes on and it says, basically, men don't beat your children. It's a funny animated spot. And the woman in so many countries is not empowered enough to bring up directly subject with the man. But here's the spot that they both watch on national television. And so the woman is now empowered because she can talk to her husband about the message that's in the spot that they both watch. And she's the one then that's going to create the change. And all I've done is created a tool that acts as a catalyst for her to create the discussion with her husband.
So then looking, you know, again, at these initiatives and, you know, assisting in these global ways and even more locally, do you believe social impact is an important part of how business operates?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's become more and more and more important. As I said, that when I started my company in Canada, there was no such thing as a social enterprise. And now there are hundreds of thousands of companies around the world. I think countries like India have had a very long tradition of social enterprises. I mean, if you look at some of the biggest companies in India for many years, like the Tatas, for example, which is one of the biggest groups in India, it was actually started as what we would call today a social enterprise because it had charitable aims for the company, and their profits are used for charities. So I think that you know, having a double or triple, what they call a triple bottom line, you know, certainly having an impact. I don't think you can get away from that. And I think that human rights and business have become much more important. I mean, right now, for going back to the Congo, for example, one of the reasons why the conflict has grown is because the price of lithium has gone up considerably because of demand for cobalt for car batteries and phone batteries and so on. And 60% of the world's cobalt comes from Congo. So there's a great incentive. Now, all the major companies in the world that are using batteries need to understand where their cobalt has come from, how was it mined, who mined it, whether it was a child or an adult, and the entire supply chain from that mine to whenever they use it, say in California or China or wherever they're going to use it in a battery. So I think that no company, no major company nowadays can completely get away from having some kind of social conscience, if you want to call it that.
I think experiences that I've had, and I'm quite young, but I've been able to see that we are such a global economy that it's very hard to even get away from it because everything is so evident, right? Everything is so transparent. Yeah. There is no reason not to help people now, and there's also no way to get away from it. And I mean that in a very, very objective way. What I mean is that companies are now more focused on helping people because you just have to, right? We're so globalized and we work so well together, right? Like, you know, we manufacture things in Canada, in the States, and then they're shipped back to Canada, and even farther, you know, in Japan and Taiwan, we work with these countries. We're a global economy, right? There's no reason not to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, it's the converse too. If you don't do it, your stock price can go down. Because people will notice. I mean, people ask questions at annual term meetings, you know, where does cobalt come from in your battery or whatever? You know, what is the supply chain? How is this garment made in Bangladesh? Sorry. So I don't think that even the biggest companies in the world can get away from not paying attention to the social and humanitarian issues that we all face in the world. It's terribly important. If a country has a particular problem, let's say there's a huge outbreak of Ebola in a country like in West Africa, it impacts all the companies there. It impacts all the companies doing business with that country. It impacts all the supply chain that, you know, the company is exporting, whatever the company is exporting. So every company has a huge incentive now to pay attention to the global, what I normally call the human condition.
Wow. It's so true. And, you know, I see it everywhere now, even in I'm from Barrie, Ontario, and it's only 165,000 people, but I'm even seeing it here, like the ripple effects of that global economy, are just there. And it's something that needs to be, you know, addressed on all levels, especially business now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are companies all over the world that are impacted by these kinds of things. And there's so many places where companies and human rights get intertwined. I mean, Canada right now, we're dealing with this question of Saudi Arabia, and, you know, the Prime Minister had made some statements about human rights activists in Saudi Arabia. In the States, they're talking about some pastor who's been incarcerated in Turkey. So, I mean, and these have huge impacts on companies, because if you're doing business between Canada and Saudi Arabia, or between the US and Turkey in those examples, you're going to get impacted. Even if nothing else, I mean, the exchange rate might change, or there might be sanctions that you can't get around, or whatever. So I think that human rights, human security, human development, are all intertwined with commerce now. They can't be untangled, and they shouldn't be untangled. And any business leader who thinks, oh, well, you know, I'm just doing business and I'm not involved and that's just politics or whatever, is just burying his head in the sand or her head in the sand.
Yeah, really. I couldn't agree more. So then the final question, just to really encapsulate it all, for anyone watching or, you know, anyone that that is thinking about becoming the next big business leader or in any general sense, what's your advice for them to begin making a social impact in their communities?
Well, first they need to find out what their passion is. I mean, I have told many young people in particular, just go for your passion, go for it. Don't let anybody stop you. Don't let anybody tell you it can't or shouldn't be done. Just go for it, especially if you're young. You know, failure is part of being an entrepreneur. I've been an entrepreneur for a long time. And yes, I readily admit that I've had failures too. I think that failure is being part of being part of a business leader or being part of an entrepreneur. You learn from your failures. So I do think that people should just go for their passion. I work in my passion. I have no boss. I have no big office. I am just one person. I don't have a support staff or anything. And I don't consider myself a business leader. I consider myself maybe a social impact person, but certainly not a business leader. But I think that if you want to be a business leader, find your passion that you want to create a business in, or you want to have an impact in that particular area, and just go for it and see what happens. You know, that's really all you need as a social entrepreneur. Yes, you need funding. Yes, you need patience. Yes, you need to be a very diverse kind of person. I mean, you know, if I want coffee or if I have to take the trash out of my office, there's nobody else to do it. I have to do it. So all I'm saying is that you need a lot of different skill sets and a different kind of setup. But ultimately, you just need passion to be a social entrepreneur.
Passion. It's always the source. It is.
It is. I mean, if you think you can make a difference, then you have a duty to do that. If you can save the life of a child, you must do it. If you can bring somebody out of the crushing burden of poverty and scarcity, then that is your duty. And if you have the talent to make a difference in the world, then you have to use it. You have to use it. So I think that there's absolutely no doubt that the bottom line for me is that as an individual, if you think you can make a difference, if that's something you want to do, just go for it. Hmm. I mean, I would just encourage that person to say, okay, you know, I'm going to try. Every company, the biggest company in the world right now is Apple. It was started by two guys in the garage, you know, two guys in the garage. And it's the biggest, most valued company in the world. So, you know, you never know what's going to happen.
I like that. You never know what's going to happen.
Yeah, so don't be scared of the future. You know? That's and Steve Jobs is a good example because he started, you know, with his friend, Apple in the garage, and then look what happened to him. At one point, he was thrown out of his own company, and then he came back, and now it's the most valued company in the world. So, you know, I'm sure that when Steve Jobs started, he had no idea what was going to happen, and I'm sure that when he was in, you know, progress, and the company was going down, and he was thrown out of his own company, he had no idea what that was going to happen. And then when he came back, he probably had no idea the incredible success Apple has become. So, you know, people aren't clairvoyant, you know. they just do their best and they go for it in their fashion and they make a difference.
But it's true, even in, you know, another example, Jack Ma from Alibaba, I think he was, I might get the statistic wrong, but I think it was 10 times he was declined employment with KFC. Like these things are real. Yeah. These are real happenings, and now Alibaba is one of the largest companies in the world too. Like,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, Einstein was the best example of this. Apparently, he got rejected all over the place, including in university in Switzerland, the first time around. He used to get letters from his teachers saying you'll never amount to anything and things like that. I mean, you know, and if Einstein hadn't said true and hadn't said, you know, I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to, in his fields. And what a contribution the man made. Now, just think the teacher had said, you're not going to amount to anything to him. And he took that seriously enough to not do anything. I mean, the world would be a lot poorer place because of it.
You're right. You're right. It's true. Just really stay true to yourself. And I think that's a rhetoric that's much more common now. People are you know, believing in that because it's being told more, right? It's being told more that if you believe in yourself that you'll get that next step. There's a lot less people that say you can't do it. And I like that change, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I had the same issue when I started. I mean, when I told people I was going to start a hybrid company and I was going to work on for-profit media projects to fund non-profit media projects, and that I would give away my work for free, which I still do to this day, because anybody can go to my Vimeo channel, download it, and use any of my videos for free. People, more than one accountant and international affairs expert gave me a highly quizzical look and said, what? You know, you're going to give away your work for free? What business model is that? Well, I mean, I've been in business. I fed myself and my family for 23 years, 24 years. And I still think I made the right call. Some people want to become billionaires. I have absolutely no feeling that I would ever want to become billionaires. A billionaire, if I ever did, I would just give the money away. But some people want to do that, and it's fine. I mean, if they achieve it and they create a lot of jobs and they create a lot of wealth, that's absolutely great. But other people want to do things like save lives. I mean, I've met many people, like doctors, for example, who could have flourishing practices in, Toronto or New York or wherever, but instead are treating patients in Ouagadougou or wherever because they want to make a difference. Maybe they don't want to do it their whole life. Maybe they just want to do it for a temporary basis. Maybe they just want to take a break from the high pressure of being a high paid doctor in Western countries. I don't know, but there are many, many people in this world now making a difference. The huge difference is that we live in a globalized world. I mean, when I started in mass communications 25 years ago, the world could only receive information passively through radio or television. Mm-hmm. Now we're in an era of instant global two-way communications, and that has changed everything. So the doctor who is in Ouagadougou can communicate with his family or can communicate with specialists if he needs to instantly, which he couldn't do, just even 5-10 years ago. So I think that's made a huge difference. In terms of the world, I think, has become a smaller place. The world is shrinking. Every year the world is shrinking as technology makes information accessible to more and more and more people. I saw this when we created videos. We created three videos on the Ebola crisis three years ago. In West Africa had the Ebola crisis. And I created one video that was called Going for the Living that we finally put into 17 West African languages, and about 80% of West Africa could watch it in their own language. And how it began to get around is not through television, and how did it reach villages is through cell phones, mobile phones. So then in Africa, in some of the poorest countries in Africa, we had a video going viral being passed from phone to phone to phone to phone. And that impact in a small, tiny village without any television you know, you could never have gotten the video dance on television, or DVDs or anything like that, was absolutely enormous. Because people are watching it personally on their own video. They can play it, they can replay it, they can talk about it. You know, they can send it to their own friends. It's a whole different experience than watching something passively on television or listening to it on radio. Or even worse, the international community started trying to stop the spread of Ebola by making pamphlets and posters. And pamphlets and posters require literacy, and you need to get it out, you know, to people. Well, in many of those villages, the literacy rate was like 20 or 30%, so they weren't going to be able to read pamphlets and posters. Yeah. So visual media had a huge impact in Ebola, and it was all because of modern technology, all because of mobile phones and cell phones.
It truly is incredible how connected we're becoming. And I don't think becoming small is necessarily a bad thing, right? It means that we're more connected together through a medium that sometimes might feel disconnected, but we have a chance to really make that a way to help out in a more global way, right?
Yeah. Technology can be good and technology can be bad. It depends on how it's used. Yeah. There's no doubt that technology has also been used for the bad. I mean, many acts of violence have happened because people have come together because of technology to create the act of violence. So I have no doubt that not everything is good. And technology needs to be regulated. Content on the internet needs to be regulated, and companies like Facebook and Twitter and so on do have a responsibility to make sure that, you know, that there's not complete freedom of speech, because freedom of speech has certain limitations. As far as I'm concerned, I'm a human rights person, but I still believe that you can't infringe on somebody else's human rights. So. Yes, technology can be used for good, technology can be used for bad, but just think of this. Right now, this instant, if, I don't know, a monk is beaten up in Asia somewhere, you know, you and I could know that instantly, absolutely instantly. We can react to it instantly, we can watch it on video instantly, we can pass it over to our friends, we know about it. We don't need to turn on our television. It's, you know, it's on our phone, which is right with us, or on iPads or whatever. And we can put pressure on the government that's doing that kind of thing to stop doing it. So it can be an enormous, it can be really, really good. And there are lots of applications in the health sphere, in the human rights sphere, in disease prevention and so on, where technology has changed everything, absolutely changed our way of thinking and our doing.
Wow, that's amazing. Fredos, thank you so much for being on the podcast. Everything that you've said has made me want to go back into a lot of the work that I did with Global Citizen and Humanitarian Aid, because there really, like you said, is a need to, if you have the ability to help, help. Right, and I think that's really what I took away from this conversation. So I really do want to thank you for being on the show and everything that you said.
Well, my generation now trusts you. It is up to you to keep our collective hope alive. So thank you for having me on your podcast. It's been a pleasure.